What is your guilty pleasure? No, not that kind of guilty pleasure. This is not that kind of podcast. No, my guilty pleasure is politics. And in particular, the way politics is as much about relationships as it is about policy. So here is On the Couch, a new podcast from Reaction with me, Lucy Beresford, broadcaster and psychotherapist, taking a deep dive into the relationships making the headlines in politics today and exploring the psychology and personalities in political life. In this week's episode, I'm looking at the psychology of making a political choice, of how the electorate behaves differently in different types of elections, and what motivates politicians really. So who better to have on my couch than Peter Cardwell, political editor of Talk Radio and former special advisor to four cabinet ministers. Welcome, Peter.
Great to be here, Lucy. Thanks for asking me.
Now, you are wearing these two hats. As I say, you're a former SPAD, former special advisor to these four ministers. And also you're a political editor and political commentator now. You will have seen your fair share of election campaigns, local election campaigns, up close and personal. So we've got local elections coming up in parts of the UK. How different do they feel when you're on the doorstep? How different are local elections to general elections?
It's a strange one because people view elections in different ways, certainly from the perspective of activists, of those volunteers handing out those leaflets. And you've got to remember that most political parties in this country are mostly volunteers. The people who get paid either to be a councillor or an MP or a special advisor are the minority. So it's a different dynamic. If you're handing out leaflets, knocking doors, a lot of people just see that as a political party calling at your door, bothering you, asking you questions that you perhaps don't want to answer. Sometimes people give the leaflets back. Sometimes people say, not today, thank you. And most of the time people just take the leaflet and say, thank you very much, and have no further kind of questions.
So very little engagement, actually.
Very little engagement. And what you're trying to do is work out whether that person is going to vote for your party or not, and tick them off a list, essentially, and work out whether you need to talk to them again, whether you need to send another leaflet on a future occasion, or whether you need to, I hate the phrase, knock them up on election day.
Which That's a whole different podcast.
well, it is. Just knock their door and get them out to the polling station. So for the people on the receiving end, I think it's just a political party. For the people who are campaigning, certainly it is a matter of, well, we're not talking about national events, we're talking about local events, but obviously national events will colour how people view those local elections. And they're often seen as a referendum on the national party. And what is probably quite unfair, actually, is that local councillors, many of whom work very, very hard doing the local council stuff, like potholes and is your streetlight working and with the local planning permission sorted out, they suffer or indeed benefit from what's happening with the party nationally.
That's an interesting one, because I heard in PMQs this week, in Prime Minister's Questions this week, when Keir Starmer was speaking about the local elections, he actually mentioned a windfall tax on big oil companies, even though he must surely know that local councils have zero power to hammer the likes of, you know, British Gas or BP or Shell with any kind of tax grab at all. That's not a local election issue. But presumably he was just hoping that people listening don't know the difference between a big local issue and a big national issue, and was trying to conflate the two.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And it's interesting because Prime Minister's Questions is obviously one of the most watched bits where people engage with politics. They'll perhaps see a clip on the news. That's the main thing, and that's what they want you to hear. And certainly in regard to local elections, that if Keir Starmer was going to say, well, we're going to fill in all the potholes, or we're going to sort out all the cycling lanes, that's less sexy, really, than saying we're going to put a windfall tax on these, you know, evil oil and gas companies hoovering up all your money with their energy bills. So certainly a lot of people don't quite realise the power of local councils, or the lack of power that they have. And they feel, just in the same way at a national election where they feel they're voting for, you know, Boris or Jeremy Corbyn, as was the choice in many people's minds the last time, they're actually voting for a constituency MP, which is something totally different. So the way people engage with politics, certainly in this country, there's a lot of cloak and dagger, I think, and Keir Starmer was doing that. Boris Johnson was doing it as well yesterday at Prime Minister's Questions. Sure. And but also, I think that they're exploiting people's lack of understanding, but there's also kind of an almost a willful lack of understanding from people as well. Often when they go to the polls thinking, well, actually, I'm voting for the government or not the government rather than the local council down the road.
And in a way, that's the interesting psychology of the electorate, isn't it? That you can't really tell on what basis somebody is going into a local election voting booth. They may very well, as you say, want to vote for the person who says they're going to empty the bins more regularly or keep the council tax down, or they could want to give the government of the day a kicking, or they might just want to vote for someone they've heard of. And you're trying to pick all that up, all that intel up, maybe from body language, maybe from questions they do ask, or the fact that they take your leaflet and slam the door in your face. You're having to really read the room every single doorstep you encounter.
Oh, completely. And actually, I was talking to a friend of mine recently. He's just become British. She's just got her British nationality after living in this country for 15 years. And she was talking about a local Labour councillor who had helped her with a local issue. And then she said, it's the local election, but I don't want to vote Labour. I don't like the Labour Party. And I said, but this local councillor has helped you with a local issue. Why don't you give that person your vote? You're voting for them. You're not necessarily voting for their party. Although, and I think she was probably convinced by that, which was good. But at the same time, you never know the psychology. The turnout is often a lot lower. So it's often the more core vote. And I think actually, if you look at the Rwanda policy recently, the policy of shipping off would-be asylum seekers to Rwanda, that is a policy which is purely a national policy. That is immigration policy. That has nothing to do with local government. But is it an accident that it came 2 or 3 weeks before the local elections, when the core Conservative vote, which may be reluctant to vote Conservative at the moment because of all the scandals that are going on, I think that was a very clear get out the vote, get out the core vote. Because in local elections, sometimes the turnout is as low as 25%, whereas in national elections, it's a lot higher.
Well, I'd like to come on to the matter of turnout in local elections being so low, but I can't help but pick you up on that idea about immigration and the timing, because some polling had come out only a couple of weeks ago, which showed that immigration had dropped to a very low figure in the list of, let's say, the top 10 or top 15 issues that people were most preoccupied by. Actually, immigration was now really low as sort of 10 or 11, and really big chunky things like cost of living crisis, very immediate in your face issues, were much more to the fore. So you still think that immigration has the potential to be a really vote winner for the Tory party?
You're absolutely right, Lucy. But at the same time, it's not just what people care about, it's what people will vote on. So I think the cost of living crisis, they probably feel the government's not doing a huge amount for them. But what would the Labour Party really do differently? It hasn't particularly set out massive things they would do differently, apart from windfall tax, which Rishi Sunak now seems to be considering. But in terms of what will actually motivate people to go out to the polls, the core Conservative vote will be motivated by a policy on immigration. And that we're going to hear more about that between now and the local elections, whereas they can't wave a magic wand on cost of living. They're trying to, but they can't. So it's a matter of what motivates people to vote and how you can encourage people to vote. So you're absolutely right. Fewer people care about it. The other thing is the trans issue. There was a huge poll recently. I think only 3 or 4% of people said the trans issue, what is a woman, is a big issue for them. But the people who care about that really care about it. And a number of people on various things like Mumsnet and so on saying, you know, they won't vote Labour because Keir Starmer can't define who a woman is. Well, that 4% could make a difference in some local elections. So weaponising that issue, even though it's not important to many people, but it's really important to the people it's important to. And I think that's the case with immigration as well.
That's going to be interesting then, isn't it? Whether we're dealing with noise or volume in terms of trans issues, but some other topics as well, that there can be a lot of noise around something, but that doesn't actually necessarily equate to volume. And as you say, whether enough people can really be motivated to vote on that topic.
Well, the classic was get Brexit done as a phrase. I mean, one of the best phrases ever in terms of motivating people to vote. I was campaigning in that election in South Swindon for my former boss, Robert Buckland. I was the number two on his campaign. We were knocking doors, and almost everybody we spoke to, whether they were pro-Remain or pro-Leave, they would have said, you know, it's such a mess. Let's just get Brexit done. Let's just get it over with. It's the kind of thing someone would say to you.
Yeah.
Ambiguity helps. A lack of clarity helps. As long as you're motivating people to go out and vote, that's what matters.
So the psychology of it is to get those people to go out and vote. But once they voted, what are your predictions for these local elections on the 5th of May? Do you think the result will be so bad for Boris Johnson or for the Conservative Party in general that it would trigger the submission of new letters to Sir Graham Brady?
I think there will be more letters to Sir Graham Brady. I don't know if they're going to meet the 54. No one quite knows how many are in. People say 30 or 40. There might be more. The people who have recently very publicly withdrawn those letters are people who have done that in a very high profile way. Number 10 has asked them to do it in a high profile way, but it's only a few of them. I think a lot of Conservatives are waiting to see what happens at the local elections. They have a very transactional relationship with Boris Johnson. And the question is he a vote winner? Is he someone who is an asset? And certainly the polling would suggest that he is a liability. But at the same time, the question that hasn't been confirmed by actual polling evidence so far. And I think that there's going to be a number of effects. So one, if you have between 700 and 800 Conservative councillors who lose their seats, that's not just them. That's their friends. That's the people who go out and give the leaflets. Those are valuable people in 2024 for the elections in which Boris Johnson will presumably want to still be leader of the Conservative Party and want to run for a historic sixth term. We're in a situation where there's a lot of vulnerability, there's a lot of people waiting and seeing, a lot of pondering about this, a lot of people not wanting to rock the boat between now and next Thursday. But after that, all bets are off. No one voluntarily decides to go from Downing Street. The decision is made by other people, and it's a matter for Conservative backbenchers who will wait and see, and then I think the knife will be plunged.
Well, psychologically, I do find this very interesting in terms of who's making a choice, because certainly research has shown that when people have to make a very big decision, they often factor in how much time they have to make that decision. So obviously, deciding whether to pull a child out of a burning building, you haven't got much time to think about that. Whereas plans to topple your leader, you almost have too much time. You have endless time. And that gives you what we often call redundant deliberation, where you're constantly seeking new pieces of information to fit to the jigsaw so that you could then say, I've got all the bits of information I need, all the pieces of jigsaw now. But do you think that's why so few letters have gone in then? That actually it's
about
people saying, I need one more bit of information. I need the elections. I need the Sue Gray report. I need the fines.
Yes, definitely. It's all those things. You're absolutely right, Lucy. But it's also the fact that there is a lack of a clear successor to Boris Johnson. There is a lack of knowing exactly where this is going to go. People talk about Jeremy Hunt, Liz Truss. But for such a long time, Rishi Sunak, it was just pretty clear that a lot of people wanted him to be the successor. There are a lot of goings on behind the scenes to make that happen when the time came. And we're in a situation now where people just don't know how it's going to go. And if you're someone who has made a transactional relationship with Boris Johnson, for example, people on Brexit, the ERG, the part of the Conservative Party that cares about all that more than anything else, well, then you're wondering, who is the person we can make a deal with now? Is there another candidate? And that takes time as well. But I also think there is a real lack of will to move because of the self-interest of a lot of MPs thinking, well, actually, do I need to risk this? Do I need to put my own position on the line, which is either possibly a minister at the time, cabinet minister, you know, no cabinet minister resigned. We've only seen one junior minister resigning, a justice minister not many people have heard of. There are a lot of those factors, as well as just moving against the leader, which is quite a big thing to do. So I think this redundant deliberation idea is definitely a strong one.
I, though, have also got something I wanted to pick your brains about in terms of that psychology. So you say to me, well, you know, it's a bit like if for a murder, you need, you know, some motivation and your opportunity. And for conservative regicide, you do need motive and a successor. But when Theresa May was having so much difficulty within her party, it never seemed to me that there was a slam dunk successor to her. And quite a lot of people would not have put money necessarily on Boris Johnson because he seemed to be making such a hash of things at the Foreign Office. But nevertheless, people were agitating for her to go for a very long time, even though there wasn't an obvious successor.
Yes, but I totally agree with that. But I think there are a number of other factors as well. You've got to remember the precarious nature of the Conservative Party in terms of its numbers, its relationship with the DUP at that stage. But you're absolutely right. And as one person who I think will stand and not win in the Conservative leadership election said to me recently, that he thought that the thing that people don't remember is that in a Conservative leadership election, you've just got to be the last one standing. It's not necessarily the best candidate. It's a matter of picking people off over a very short period of time, actually, through this kind of Agatha Christie and then there was one kind of scenario. So it's a very strange way to stand for leadership. It's not the way that Labour does things or the Liberal Democrats or any other political party getting down to the final two. So that, by its nature, influences the process as well.
And how much of an impact do you think that very, or I suppose infamous, Heseltine moment of, you know, flouncing out of the cabinet and saying, you know, I shall be making a statement shortly, which was the beginning of him standing, but then of course not succeeding. How illustrative was that of that idea that he who wields the knife never wears the crown? And do you think a lot of MPs are nervous about that? They don't ever want to be the one that puts their head above the parapet.
Yes, absolutely. But also they have a great desire to be that Heseltine, to be that hero who finally said, you know, enough is enough and I'm going to challenge the leader, and the admiration that that brings as well. Because if you look at the nature of the Labour Party, for example, I remember one Labour insider saying to me one time, you know, Labour loves a loser. Look at how much they revere Neil Kinnock. Look at how much Ed Miliband was feted and loved after he stopped being a disastrous leader of the Labour Party. He's kind of almost now a kind of national treasure kind of figure. Ed Balls in the same way. And it's interesting from that perspective. But yeah, the sort of huge ego moments of Heseltine. Another one I would say is David Davis resigning and standing again over legislation in regard to privacy. So I think there's a number of factors in that, but whether they actually want to say, well, I'm going to resign, but by resigning and having a principled stand, it shows that I'm probably not going to be the leader. And all 650 MPs, I mean, I remember people say this to me all the time, said, oh, you know, do you think Rishi Sunak wants to be Prime Minister? Do you think this person wants to be Prime Minister? Do you think this person wants to be Prime Minister? There are 650 MPs and all of them want to be Prime Minister. Even Caroline Lucas, the Green Party leader, is thinking in the back of her mind somewhere, she's thinking, you know, if there's a coalition and we got a few more MPs and this kind of happened and this kind of happened, maybe one day I could be Prime Minister. They all think that. It's all in the back of their minds and they all think they could do it, because a big part of politics and putting yourself forward for election is ego. And even if you're someone who never in a month of Sundays is going to be Prime Minister, you still think maybe one day it could be me.
And do you think that's why some people actually go into politics, to have not so much to have that ego stroke, or maybe to have that ego stroked, but in slightly more subtle ways? You know, the rest of us are scrabbling around hoping to get various likes on our social media page. What they're doing is hoping to get loads of votes, and then they can turn to that to themselves and say, I am worth this much because I've had this number of votes.
Oh, absolutely. And they look at the thousands of votes that they got, which may or may not be anything to do with them or not a huge amount to do with them personally, and say, well, 17,000 people think I'm the best person to be the MP for this constituency.
That goes to this idea of local elections and whether people, and general elections as well, as whether people are actually voting for the name of the party, the leader of the party, or your local MP. Presumably all MPs psychologically would prefer to believe that the constituents are voting for them.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, every MP I've ever come across ever has an ego of some description. Sometimes it's a matter of insecurity, having the ego coming through there. Sometimes they're just very pompous and love themselves and think they're a wonderful human being who can save the world. But, you know, it is definitely a huge thing. Elections are all about ego, and the crushing lack of losing, for example, is a big blow to the ego, even if it's a matter of being in a constituency where you're always going to lose anyway because of boundary disputes or whatever, they all want to think it's about them in some way. Sometimes it is as well. Sometimes there are local MPs who, you know, even in a bad time for the party, increase the majority, for example, and they, you know, there is a personal vote for some MPs, but it's rare.
So if you win your seat, it's all down to you. But if you lose it, it was down to your leader, yes, to your party.
Yes, exactly. And the ambiguity and the fact that you can't possibly ever really know what is in the mind of people when they're in the polling booth, whether it's, oh, well, my dad always voted for Labour, therefore I'm going to vote for Labour, or whether it's the local candidate, Lucy Beresford, is a marvellous local councillor, therefore I'm going to vote for her because she fixed my pothole. You know, there's no way of ever really knowing what is happening or what was going through people's minds. Therefore, you create your own narrative.
Yeah, and we do that in life in general. We create our own narrative. We tell ourselves stories in order to survive. Peter Cardwell, political commentator, political editor at Talk Radio, and former special advisor to 4 cabinet ministers. Thank you so much for being on my couch today.
Lovely to be with you.